I think it's helpful to remember that the Beatitudes are not statements, they're exclamations, which is why some translations will say, happy are those. But that English word is not so good, because happy gives away its own case. It contains the root hap, which means chance. You've heard the expression happen chance, okay? Well, that's the problem with hap, okay? Happy. Human happiness is something which is dependent upon chances, which come and go. Life gives and life takes away. It's all by chance. But not so with the meaning of these exclamations. So I avoid the translation happy. It's not a good, accurate one. Because this is about blessedness. It's about joy that nothing can take away. So these are not pious hopes about what shall be. They're congratulations on what is. This blessedness exists here and now. It's not something that the Christian is going to enter into. The very form of blessedness or beatitudes is a statement. It's the thrill and the radiance of gladness in Christian life. Their greatness is that they're not wistful glimpses of some future beauty. They're not even golden promises about some distant glory. These are triumphant announcements of what is, a permanent joy that nothing in this world can take away. So when Matthew sets about collecting these sayings of Jesus and putting them together in Greek, he used very strong words, very intense words for every one of them. Tokos is the word he chooses for this first beatitude. Tokos. Say it.
Tokos.
One more time. Tokos. Oh, you're getting Greek, okay? By Wednesday night, you're going to have quite a vocabulary. Tokos, poor, is an unfortunate English translation of tokos, because it doesn't carry the full weight and the full meaning of what's being proposed. Poor is the woman observed putting her offering at the temple. She has little to give, but by her gift, she becomes tokos. She's not tokos until she gives the gift. Because as long as she has anything to give, she's not poor. She's destitute when she becomes poor. Tokos is also the word that Luke uses to describe Lazarus in the parable I just read. It describes absolute, complete destitution. Nothing is what this is all about. Complete and total dependency. It is this radical idea that then leads the disciples or the apostles of Jesus to react so desperately when Jesus talks about how it is easier to pass through the eye of a needle than for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. The suggestion that wealth and prosperity are not a blessing and do not show that they're favored, as many at the time believed, was a startling suggestion. And then proposing the absolute opposite was unthinkable. We might recall that the giving of the law with Moses was accompanied by promises of blessing. And that wealth and prosperity were given as signs of God's pleasure. That was a very long-lasting belief. As Israel came out of the desert into Canaan, it grew prosperous. And it became evident to the prophets that wealth brought great temptation to break the covenant. It wasn't simply wealth, of course. It was that attitude of self-satisfaction that so often accompanied the acquisition of the wealth. And that often turned people away from God. Seized by the passion for possession, for security, for power, those rich were willing to do absolutely anything to build their homes of ivory and their summer palaces. So the prophets came along and confronted this. And the prophets turned to the poor of the land as the only hope for maintaining the covenant with God. The poor had nothing to cling to but God. And so the prophets proclaimed that the future restoration would be built upon this remnant represented by the poor. The kingdom would belong to them, not to the rich. It wasn't because God didn't care for the rich and powerful, but because the rich and the powerful had a way of regarding themselves as self-sufficient and without need of God. So, they don't need God, God doesn't need them. Into this stuff steps the rabbi Jesus with this beatitude. There is only one thing we need, and those who have it are blessed. There's an old Jewish proverb that says you cannot eat at both tables. It springs from this thinking about those who have a lot of things being blessed and favored by God. Of course, the unspoken other side of that, but we have to remember it, is the thinking then that those who have nothing are out of favor with God, or that God's abandoned them. The wonderful Old Testament book of Job challenges this kind of thinking, so contrary to the reality of life. Bad things happen to good people. Every day, this reality is confirmed. Job is as good as a person could be. Yet, in the story, he is struck down again and again by one catastrophe after another. So his friends, they insist that he must have sinned, which is the only way they can understand what has happened to him. But Job insists that he's not sinned. And of course, the author's purpose is that we believe Job. By the end of the story, Job is restored to prosperity, but not before this concept of God is shattered and replaced by a far more profound idea of God. And this is the heart of the matter. Before we can enter into beatitude life, our concept of God has to be purified and fine-tuned. If there's any trace of that old thinking that prosperity is a sign of God's favor, you're not ready. The concept has to be revisioned. That's what happened to Job. He came to a much more profound idea of God and a much more mature and healthy relationship as a consequence. What the prophets were looking for then was a spiritual attitude, a disposition of soul that we have to call poverty. It's a self-dispossession which made room for the Word of God. The meaning of this poverty is seen in the beginning of Luke's gospel. There are characters there who are poor. Mary, Elizabeth, Zachary, and Simeon. They all conform to this image of the Anawim, the faithful poor waiting patiently for the Lord. Think of Mary, who in her Magnificat praises God for looking upon the lowliness, the tokos, of his handmaid. Mary was poor in spirit. She was of the kingdom. She didn't cling to anything. Not even her own understanding of what her virginity might mean. But then comes Jesus, and no one is more poor than him. He is the full realization of poverty. And of course, inasmuch as he is the revelation of what God is, then we can say that God is poor. The obedience of Jesus is a manifestation of that poverty. He gave up everything. He gave up his privileged place at the Father's right hand to come here. He gave up even his own will to do the will of the Father. As this kind of doctrine then begins to develop, there's a growing belief that there was a sharp distinction between the present age and the age to come, which was God's age and the age of reward. This is what provides that idea of the two tables. You can't eat at both. If you have your reward in this world, then there's no reason to expect a reward in the time to come. All kinds of parables and sayings of Jesus point to this truth. So what good is it to store up riches? Think of that parable about the rich man and Lazarus and what happens in the age to come. Remember how the Lord observes those who make a great show of their piety in order to impress the world around them? They can expect nothing in the time to come because they already have their reward. Jesus insists that it's useless to store up anything, even if we can, and even if we do preserve them. Guess what? We can't even preserve our lives. So what's the point of all this preservation? To whom will it go? Asked Jesus. Our efforts to hold on to things is really useless in this world. People spend all kinds of money these days on security systems, and they arm them while they go out to dinner. And then they die in a car wreck on the way home. There's a great song from Showboat that describes the reality of this life. It just keeps rolling, it just keeps rolling along. Heraclitus was often called the weeping philosopher. He once said, "You can't step into the same river twice. By the time you step into it the second time, it's not the same river, and you're not the same person." So the effort to hang on to things gets called into question. That's mine. I've got it. This is the thinking of someone in for a rude surprise. Once you set a goal and achieve it, you've had your reward. The challenge ever before is to get deeper into the poverty Jesus speaks of in this sermon. To do so helps us, it might help to go back to Genesis. We heard it Sunday. I sat there through each of the masses thinking, wait till tomorrow night I get to talk about that. That serpent, you know. He says that if you eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge, your eyes will be opened and you will be as God, knowing good from evil. The subtlety of this comes from the other version that states that God made male and female in his own image and likeness. He already did that. So that's to say, it's not simply a temptation to wish to be like God. That's not the temptation. We're already made like God. We're created, intended, and meant to be like God by reason of the way God made us. That's not the temptation. There's nothing wrong with the temptation to be like God. We'd all be a lot better off if we could get that right. Forgiving like God, generous like God, you see? The problem is the idea that we, or Adam and Eve, that we could make ourselves be like God. God does that. We don't. What the serpent offers is a distortion of possessing something that's already there. The serpent is seeking to propose a new concept of ownership. Likeness to God was something that God had already given. Originally, there was nothing that man or woman had to do on their own. Think about it. When all creation had been given to them, what could they do to possess something that they already had been given by God? Satan suggests that they should do something to become like God, that they should take their likeness to God in their own hands. The gesture of taking the fruit and eating the fruit is a symbol of man taking something into his own hand and storing it away safely inside of himself. You see, the evil of this is the eating, because it's a symbol of security and possession, which has become such an obsessive concern for fallen human people. When they eat it, nobody else can have it, you see? All gone, mine. Possession is the issue. Possessiveness is destructive of relationships by hanging on too tightly. Something like friendship can only be possessed insofar as it's constantly received as a gift, which is ever new. I can't count the number of relationships I've seen fall apart because someone in the relationship was too possessive. Fallen human beings like things they can hang on to, or think they can. But it's really the poor in spirit who can actually have anything, because they are the ones who know how to receive gifts, since everything for them is a gift. Consider the parable of the master who goes away and leaves his property to three different people. The one who buries the money is afraid of risk. He's afraid of losing. And because of his fear, he does lose. The master wants the servants to take risks, just like the master has taken a risk by leaving his possessions in their care. That loser wants to hang on to what he got. Doesn't want to take any risks, so he buries it. Friends, that's not a good gospel plan. Think about those apostles who had 5 loaves and 2 fish. It was all theirs. But Jesus asked them to give it up. He asked them to become poor like the people around them. And when they did, remember what happened. The reason why it's so important for us to unlearn the kind of possessing that Satan proposes is that ultimately the only thing worth possessing is completely beyond possessing. When we possess nothing, then everything is available and equally shared by all. Imagine it. If everyone possessed nothing and did not hang on to anything, everything that is, everything God created would be available and equally shared by everyone. That would be an experience of blessedness. As soon as we begin to take and hold as our own, then there's that much less for everyone else. Some would call that socialism. Others might want to call it communism. I'll just call it gospelism. That's Christianity. Now, perhaps the first and most essential characteristic of tokos is the profound awareness of who we are as creatures before God. We exist moment by moment only because of the creative love and fidelity of the Father. We have and we are nothing apart from God. We're totally unnecessary. Yet much of our lives is spent avoiding this realization. It's not by chance that the first of the Beatitudes confronts the first of all sins, pride. The first characteristic of the poor is embracing this truth. We are unnecessary. Everything we have is a gift. The characteristic of this tokos is the ability to listen. One rich in this world lives with a cluttered mind and heart, with many voices and many longings and desires filling up their lives. The rich do not and cannot listen to the other because too much energy is spent listening to the conflicting shots of passion. Chris Christopherson has this song, Me and Bobby McGee, and there's a line in it. Freedom's just another word for having nothing to lose. The poor are free. I love that description of poverty. The poor person is able to leave the land of father and mother and journey to a far place on a promise, just like Abraham. The poor person is able to let another go in freedom. The poor person can hand over their body in crucifixion for others. The poor person is of the kingdom because the kingdom consists in those who hear the word of God and keep it. And only the poor can hear. As I said at the beginning, God is very poor because God clings to nothing. Blessedness is a measure of how much we resemble God and in whose image we're made. There is those verses in the hymn to the Philippians, the hymn of the Philippians, that's often sung at Vespers, evening prayer, about how Jesus did no grasping. He poured out everything. A frightening thing about this is that to become poor, you have to even surrender our grip on ourselves, which very well might mean being exposed and experiencing times of mental, emotional, and spiritual deprivations. We call this dark nights, and we've all been there. But I dare say we probably fail to understand what it means and even see it as a blessing. Think of Mother Teresa. When a few years ago her letters to her spiritual director revealed that she spent the largest part of her life in that kind of darkness, there was great shock. She probably didn't know at the time or understand that this very painful experience was her most real experience of poverty and her most intimate connection with the poor she served. I believe that this darkness is exactly what stripped her of everything she might have wanted to hold on to, leaving her with nothing. And in that poverty, she was able to realize the image of God in herself and become that angel of mercy, compassion, and self-giving by which we remember her. She became poor so that her identity with the poor lifted them up. She revealed to them a God who is poor. In every sense, the Beatitudes are a revelation of what God is. And the more we enter into these Beatitudes, the closer we come to bearing that image. Blessed are the poor in spirit, those who have allowed themselves to be stripped of acquisitiveness and security, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, because they no longer seek to possess, but to be possessed. If we ask the question, what does it mean for the kingdom of God to be ours? Then we begin to realize that it means our lives are centered upon God and imitating the very way God lives and acts. And this is the ultimate depth of a beatitude called poverty in spirit. As I said yesterday, the Jesus of Matthew's gospel is always cast in or in the image of Moses. And so here he is. By far the meekest man on the face of the earth. It is a new Moses, then, who proposes a real blessedness, a real beatitude that's found in meekness. Ready for your Greek word? Praus.
Praus.
Strong word, okay? The Greeks used that word to describe domesticating a powerful animal. Praus. It means great strength under control. These animals, these oxen, these horses, they had to be meeked important to realize that meekness is not weakness. It's quite the opposite, in fact. It's strength used in control. It's strength with discipline. Now, inherit is the word here that makes the big difference from the beatitude before it. Meekness goes along with poverty of spirit, so opposed to grasping and manipulating and perverting. And so this inherit opens up us to receiving. It's an inheritance. You can't seize an inheritance. It's a gift. It's always received. This is the way of seeing all things as a gift from God. Our own lives, first of all. It is a reverence which recognizes that where God's at work, as in creation, there's the holy. It's a response, therefore, which lets things be what they are and uses them appropriately. So meekness inherited recognizes that the kingdom of God is itself a gift that cannot be seized by our own initiative. We don't possess it. We are gifted with it, moment by moment, with the result that every moment of our lives should be characterized by thanksgiving. The meek are those who wait, knowing what they wait for has already been given and will be given again, the gift of God's own life. The meek, like the poor, are radically dispossessed because they desire nothing except that which comes from God as a gift. Those are the ones who truly are able to rejoice in, celebrate, and make use of the earth as God's children. Those who seek to grasp never really possess. The paradox of the Beatitudes, like the paradox of the kingdom, is that those who lose their lives will gain them. Those who are poor enough or meek enough, that is to say, free enough, to desire nothing but what is given, are the ones able to rejoice in all things. Blessed are the meek, who are not in too big a hurry to get things done and know how to wait, helpless, nailed to a cross. Against all the odds, these are the ones who will inherit the earth. It is the teaching of this world that the earth belongs to those who seize, that power is meant for domination, oppression, and exploitation, and that the only limits to my freedom are the limits imposed by my appetites, and that arrogance and lack of care are signs of strength. This attitude, this understanding of humanity which it expresses, has dominated much of our history in the Western world for the past 400 years. It is an idea of man based upon the myth of Prometheus. Let me tell you about that. Prometheus was a god who stole fire from the other gods so that humans might have light and warmth. That theft was regarded as heroic appropriation of an item to which man was entitled by virtue of his mere presence on the earth. Something wrong with this thinking, you see. It's entitlement. It has justified the thoughtless domination of technology in our world today. It's enabled us to throw railroads and ribbons of concrete across this land, to erect great mountains of steel and mortar, to seal our lives in plastic wrapping. But with this view of humanity, we've created a world of man, and it's destroying creation. We have forgotten that the earth belongs to another. What we are only now beginning to discover is that by seizing the earth, we've destroyed it. And in the process, we're seeing this world of man turned into a demonic world, filled not with light and hope and the optimism of science, but seething with the forces of violence and decay. With the simple blowing of a fuse, Our shining cities become chaotic nightmares of looting and murder. There's an old folk song that I grew up with. Where have all the flowers gone? We might ask more appropriately, where's the image of humanity gone? Now that the world has been shaped into the image of Promethean man, is it possible anymore to recognize ourselves? Psalm 37 gives us a focus on this beatitude, and I believe that Matthew intended it so. The psalmist looks around at the world. He sees all the wrong people prospering. The people who ought to be doing well, the righteous followers of God's law, seem to be helpless before the successes of the wicked. It doesn't make sense. So the psalmist, trying to find comfort, if not understand, meditates on the state of the world in the light of the mystery of God's plan. And the message is clear. There's no future for the wicked. Consequently, there's no need to interfere any more than necessary to make grass shrivel up like the sun. Indignation is inappropriate, and it's a long way from meekness. The meek simply laugh. The psalmist suggests that it's silly to take the unrighteous seriously. Reaction and outrage give them more substance than is their due, and it will certainly accomplish nothing but harm. In other words, evil has only as much reality as we give it. Now, that's not to suggest something simplistic. Evil is a part of the world as we know it, and it's a powerful part. So we should notice with this beatitude that there's a shift in verb tenses between the first beatitude and the second. Got to catch that. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Then blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Julian of Norwich is great mystical writer, summed up meekness best of all. All will be well. What wisdom. Our temptation is and always has been to try to achieve God's purpose by using the methods of this world. But every attempt to do so shuts off the cross of Christ. Matthew 5, verse 39 says, do not resist the evil. Do not resist the evil. If the previous beatitude suggests that something's gone wrong with our normal ideas about possession, this beatitude suggests that something's wrong with our normal ideas about attempts to get things done. In fact, it raises some question about the whole idea of trying to achieve something. As I said yesterday, this whole business of trying is suspicious to me. Trying to do something always involves a division. It means doing one thing with an eye on the other. I mean, someone may play scales on the piano because they're trying to play the piano. And some may exercise because they're trying to stay healthy. It always seems to me that this can lead to two mistakes. First, we get in this way of thinking that everything that we do needs some kind of extrinsic justification. So we become suspicious of just people who just do things because they want to. The consequence of that is it resorts to all kinds of pseudo-justifications, like going for a walk, for exercise. Or worse, we declare that walking is really important. We end up decorating harmless occupations with high-sounding meanings. Then the second thing kicks in. We forget that no amount of trying ever automatically produces the desired results. We can practice our scales and never become pianists. I had a very close friend who went running every day And one day, while showering after his run, he fell dead in the shower. 57 years old. I ain't running. Between trying and the doing, there's always a disconnect. My point is that our concern with trying to do things can often get us out of tune with God, because God doesn't try to do anything. That writer I spoke of before, Meister Eckhart, whose insights always leave me dumbfounded, said that God acts without a reason why. God does things just because God's God. Another German mystic remarked once that a rose exists without a reason why. It blooms because it blooms. Now, some biologist is going to come along and want to take that further and talk about pollens and seeds and reproduction. But by the time the biologist gets finished, there's no wonder, there's no awe left. There's hardly any beauty. But beauty is often the gateway to the divine. Aristotle used that Greek word, praus, to define the virtue between two extremes. It was for him a happy medium between opposite passions. For example, praus described a generous man as opposed to a miser or a spendthrift. A miser or a thrift. There's the generous man. He goes on to describe the difference between complete passivity and rage. He calls that meekness, the middle ground. As Aristotle saw it, there was a happy medium between too much and too little anger. And this folds over into our understanding of a capital sin called anger, which Augustine rather artificially matched to this beatitude in one of his sermons. Meekness, thought of in this way, as I said at the beginning, is not weakness. The meek are not without passion or vigorous life, and they're not without virtuous anger. It's just that they get angry about the right things, and they're never angry about any injury or affront to themselves. Power is among the great temptations Aquinas warns against, and this beatitude is its antidote. This beatitude is about yielding. This is about directing our talents to a virtuous end. Learn from me, says Jesus, for I am meek and humble of heart. We have to become students. We have to yield to the teacher. The Epistle of James insists that we must receive the meekness, with meekness, the word, which is able to save our souls. So we yield. We give control of our lives to Christ. If not, our lives are going to remain forever out of control. So if we're going to be and act like God, we have to appreciate the act of God. We have to come to appreciate the point of pointlessness, or the joy of unnecessariness. Don't you love that one? There's some meekness in learning that there's satisfaction sometimes in just doing something for its own sake. As this truth began to dawn on me not too long ago, I began to understand my mother's response and the wisdom of it when I'd say to her, "Why?" She'd look at me and shrug and say, "Because." And that's all there was to it. It was always the end of the conversation. The reason why you go to Mass is not to try and be holy or obedient. It's because you do. It's because of who you are. It's because of what Catholics do. There doesn't have to be some great and noble reason. This is meekness. The reason you go for a walk is because you want to. Because you have the gift of time. And you want to see the beauty of creation. Forget about that exercise. You don't need a reason, okay? The meek will inherit the earth. The meek can be trusted with the good of this world. They will not hold too tightly. They will use everything in creation without exploitation or abuse. The meek do not feel the need to rush out and do something. I've discovered the meekest people in this parish are sitting in that parking lot 15 minutes after Mass. Calmly. Meekness. No need to rush. It's better to rejoice in the Lord and be content to rest in his truthfulness and to gaze upon the wonder of this world, the world he has made, and to gaze upon it with the eye of faith and the heart of hope. The meek are the source of hope and the source of optimism in the face of helplessness.